Welcome back, everyone. So my name's Akasha Mitra, as I said, and I'm going to be doing the second half. And what we're doing for these few weeks is we're giving talks about Sangharakshita. I'll refer to him as Bante. Bante is a kind of a honorific title, which means teacher. So I'll refer to Sangharakshita as Bante. And we're giving talks about Bante. And most of you will know this, but Bante passed away about a month ago now, I think it was. So he died about a month ago. And Bante was the founder of our order and movement, of the Triratna Buddhist order and community. So he's an incredibly... it's a funny thing that happens. I mean, when I start to talk about this sort of thing, it's like my words slightly fail me. To say that he's important doesn't really do him justice, but you have a sense of the reverence and devotion that many of us will feel for him and still do feel for him. And for those of you that don't know him, in a sense, the fact that you're here means that your life has been touched by him. And he touched many, many thousands of lives, hundreds of thousands of lives, I think. While he was alive, he had a really, really remarkable life. He was a really remarkable man. Not least for the fact that he was born into very ordinary circumstances. So he was born in Tooting in 1925. He always said that for some reason when he told people he was born in Tooting, they sort of laughed a little bit. But it's a very ordinary place to come from. I actually made a little pilgrimage to Tooting the week after he died. I'll say a bit more about that later. I just felt like there's something that I wanted to do. I wanted to do something physical to sort of honour him. So I did this little pilgrimage around London of significant places in London to do with Bante, and went down to Tooting and kind of spent a little bit of time there and had a curry and various other things, which I'm sure he would have approved of. But... So we're giving these talks about Bante, and really what we want to do is honour him. We want to honour him, and we want to evoke something of his presence. So that's what I want to do anyway. That's what we're doing in these talks. And I thought I'd actually just start off with something a bit more personal. So it's not to do with what I'm going to talk about, but... I was on retreat last week, so I was on a retreat for the organisation that I work for called Karuna. So some of you might have heard of Karuna. We're a Triratna charity, and we fundraise in the UK and we give money to development organisations in India that work around. They work to help people that are marginalised because of caste. So very, very poor people, often living in desperate conditions in India. And once a year, our team gets together and has a retreat, which is really, really lovely. And it was a wonderful retreat. I mean, it was interesting hearing Kusala Sara saying about just being on retreat for a few days can be very, very strong. And we were on retreat just from Monday to Thursday, but it was a very, very beautiful experience. And one of the things that we did on the retreat was I led a session on rejoicing and recollecting Bante, where people just gave... they said if a particular teaching had touched them, or people read a poem, that's what they were invited to do. But actually what most people did was they just shared a personal story of Bante. So most people that were there had met him at one time or another. And there was a lovely, lovely story that my friend Sangamani said, which was, she said, Bante gave me the gift of confidence. And there were so many stories from different members of the team about how they'd met Bante. And that he just, either he clarified something for them, or he just sort of filled them with joy. And it was just a really, really wonderful thing to be in his presence. That was certainly my experience when I met him. I was lucky enough to meet him a few times, one-to-one. And I just remember feeling, particularly the second time I met him, I just felt flooded with joy to be in his presence. And then when I left, that sort of stayed with me for a few days. It was really, really wonderful, quite sort of intangible, but really wonderful. And Sangamani told this story about she has a daughter who's she's in her mid-20s now, but when she was a little girl, She was staying at the place where Bante lived at the time in Birmingham, a place called Majimaloka. And so her daughter was staying there for the week. And Bante was out in the garden one day, and her daughter Maisie was looking around the garden. And Bante asked her, he said, what are you doing, little girl? And she said, I'm looking for fairies. And then Bante later recollected this to Sangamani. And he said, yes, and she told me she was looking for fairies. And I thought, now there's a child that's being raised well. And I just thought that was really, really lovely. You know, just evoking something of how he encourages us to really develop our sort of imaginal aspect. But also just lovely that Sangamani was touched, and that gave her a real confidence. Because she said, as a young mum, she actually was kind of quite lacking in confidence. And she sort of felt like she got Bante's seal of approval. So what I want to talk about is not what I was intending to talk about. So I was going to talk about sort of Bante's particular emphases and things that he's done differently in setting up our Buddhist movement. This is what I was going to talk about. And that's something I really, really appreciate. But it's sort of a wonderful thing. Sometimes when you're preparing to give talks, you realize that actually what you've said you're going to talk about is not what you want to talk about. And I've sort of realized that with this talk. And there are a few things that have happened to me recently that sort of have kind of, I was going to say congealed, that's not the right word, is it? Maybe coalesced around a sort of particular set of thoughts. And so what I want to talk about is around ritual and its place in life and in Buddhist life. And Bante gave a lecture about this in, I think it was 1968, called The Psychology of Buddhist Ritual. And quite a few things have happened to me recently that have been extremely kind of evocative and thought-provoking. And I found this lecture by Bante, and he has a lot to say about these things that have been happening to me. So you all want to know what these things are, don't you? I can just tell. So I recently was in India. So some of you who are regular at this class will know that maybe you've noticed that I haven't been here. Maybe you haven't even noticed. I don't know. That's all right. That's fine. But I've been away for 6 weeks, actually. I was away for a while. And at the end of my time away, I think about 2 weeks before I came back, that's when Bante passed away. And it had such a strong effect on me. I wasn't quite prepared for the effect that it had on me, actually. And at that time, I wasn't with, sometimes when I work, I'm with other people from Tri Ratna, and I wasn't at that time. And it was very strange to be away from the Sangha. So I did manage to have a phone conversation with my friend Sangajit and with Nyanavacha, which I really appreciated. But I was on my own, and it had a very, very strong effect on me hearing about Bante's death. But one thing I was very pleased about was I came back just before his funeral. So I was able to go to his funeral. And I went to Bante's funeral when I came back. And was anybody there? Just put your hand up if you were there. Oh, yeah, quite a few of you were there. That's lovely. So it was just such an amazing experience. It was an incredible experience. There was about 1,200 people there. And I wouldn't say too much about it because just time won't allow me to do that, but one particular part of it really, really stayed with me, which was when his body was lowered into the ground, and then everybody was circumambulating his body. So there's hundreds of people walking around this kind of central sort of brick stupa where his body had been lowered down, and everyone was chanting, and there was this kind of incense-y stuff being burned, so there was all this smoke coming up, and it was really quite dreamlike, actually. It was really dreamlike. And and at a certain point I took myself back, and it was this very strange experience where so many people that I knew and loved, because I've been involved with this movement for a long time, you know, about 20 years on and off, was just this procession of people going past and then also following me out of the circle. And it was like, here's this person that I really, really know and love. Here's this next person that I have so much love for. Here's this person that has meant so much to me. And it was just this endless procession of people that I loved and cared about. It made me think a little bit of, like, you know, when you're a child and people tell you what it's like to go to heaven or something. You know, it was a bit like that. And it was really, really strange and dreamlike. So I was just, you know, I'd be hugging this person and then the next person. And I looked around and the atmosphere was the same between everybody, because everybody was that was there had so many connections with everybody else that was there. And it was, yeah, really, really amazing experience. And afterwards, I sort of reflected, you know, I was thinking his funeral was about 4 or 5 hours long. And it just felt like a really, really fitting tribute for such a wonderful, remarkable man that had impacted so many people's lives. And then that also made me think, actually, how sort of how inadequate most of our rituals are around death, not in our community. So one of the things that I really appreciate in Tri Ratna is actually how well we do dying and death and funerals and mourning. But my grandmother died last year and she was 100 years old. And I'm sorry to say that her funeral was a really, I just felt, not very good affair. You know, there's a few of us family members there. Somebody kind of presided over it that just seemed like they weren't really that interested at all. And just was going on and on about kind of God and fearing God a lot. And my grandmother wasn't a Christian. And I just came away, you know, thankfully we'd had this marvelous ritual the year before for her 100th birthday, which was absolutely joyful. She was surrounded by people she loved. And yeah, I just felt that her funeral was not adequate, really. It wasn't an adequate celebration of her life. And I was contrasting that with Bante's ceremony. So there was Bante's funeral. And then this is the bit that gets a bit weird. So... Then I went to a thing called Toxteth Day of the Dead, which was a really, really, really bizarre ritual organized by the Jams. So does anybody know who the Jams are? Okay, so let's take it a stage further. The Jams are also known as the KLF. Anybody know who the KLF are? Okay, Tom and two other people. Okay, five of you, six of you, that's great. Okay, so the KLF were a... kind of like a sort of situationalist anarchists that happened to be the biggest selling pop chart act of the 90s. Reconcile those two things in your mind. I don't know how you can, but they had a number one hit with What Time Is Love, Last Train to Transcentral. They made a record with Tammy Wynette. They made a fantastic record called Whitney Joins the Jams, which is basically them... begging Whitney Houston to join their band over a sample of I Want to Dance with Somebody, like over and over and over again. It sounds awful, but it's great. These two guys, very, very, very strange, and they did have like massive chart success in the 90s. They sort of turned their hand to pop music. But they're also very, very strange. They've got a whole mythology around what they do. So they basically have created this mythology that the Jams... exist to thwart the Illuminati. So do people know who the Illuminati are? Yeah, some of you will. Okay, where am I going with this? I don't know. But anyway, oh, they also famously burned £1 million at one point as well. So you may have heard of the KLF burning £1 million and filming it, which, just to say, I'm not going to answer questions about that at any point, because the ethics of it, I haven't quite worked out, but very, very interesting thing to do anyway. But they had this event called Toxteth Day of the Dead, and what it is basically they are building a pyramid in Toxteth in Liverpool, made of bricks, and the bricks, you basically sign up and you get a brick, and if you sign up, then when you die, 23 grams of your ashes goes into the brick and it gets added to the people's pyramid. And by the end, which is probably going to be something like 200 or 300 years' time, there's going to be 34,000 bricks. So I went to this thing and I've got my brick. So at some point, some of my ashes will go into the People's Pyramid. I lived in Toxteth for a long time. And it's a very special place to me. So, and there was a bit of a weird synchronicity around it because Bill Drummond, who's half of the KLF, wrote a fantastic book called 45, which changed my life. And I turned 45 on the weekend of the Toxteth Day of the Dead. So when a friend said to me, come on, you know, we've got to go to this. I went last year. It's amazing. I thought, I can't turn him down. So it was very, it was a really, really weird experience. It was like a very strange combination of just oddness, very, very deep meaning, and sort of strange mystery, really. So we gathered, and the first thing that we did was we kind of, well, they said what was going to happen during the day, and what was going to happen was we were going to do a thing of basically walking around Toxteth, doing this thing called beating the bounds, which is marking out the territory of Toxteth and stopping at certain points to honour people, living and dead, who had contributed a lot to the community or had made some important contribution. And we were sort of stopping and honouring them, basically. And there were lots of different rituals involved in that. And at the start, they showed some photos from somebody who had died since the last year. So they basically said, look, you know, this man was on the march last year. He was a friend of a lot of people here. And he died and some of his family were there and they were shedding a lot of tears. So it was a very poignant moment. And then we went outside to start this thing called Beating the Bounds, which was, well, we all got together and they played this song, which made everybody cry, basically. And it was a song by Frankie Goes to Hollywood that I always thought was really, really cheesy. But something in my heart completely opened up and we were all singing along. And then we did this march around Toxteth. And it was quite enjoyable and very interesting and very moving at points. And then at the end, basically the ritual at the end was that the first brick was going to be laid. And that's when it all got really strange and really serious. So it was dark by this point, and out of the back of this like van hire thing from Leytonstone was coming all of this luminous smoke. Jimmy Courtney was there, who's half of the KLF, but Jimmy Courtney's holding this cushion, and on the cushion was a brick, and the brick had some ashes in it, and the ashes belonged to his brother, who had died a year earlier. So his Jimmy Courtney's brother had committed suicide a year earlier. And he's there holding this brick. And this was the brick that was going to be the first brick in the People's Pyramid. So this is no joke. This was actually like really, really serious. And then at that point, yeah, it all got very, very, very serious and very moving. So we'd gone from this thing earlier in the day, which was, oh, I forgot to say as well, that when you first went in, it was in Toxteth Town Hall, and there was a sign on the door saying there's going to be an unexpected item in Toxteth Town Hall, and you go in, and it was a pyramid about 40 feet high made of shopping trolleys. And then there was kind of tea and mince pies and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, there we were laying this brick from this man who died. So it might have been strange, but it was very, very, very serious, and there was this whole kind of ritual around it. So I'd gone from Bante's funeral to Toxteth Day of the Dead, and then last week I was on the Karen, our team retreat, where we were, one of the things we did was recollect and rejoice in Bante. So one of the things that was interesting, I think, is that Jimmy Courtney had said that the reason why he started Toxteth Day of the Dead and the reason why they wanted to do this thing was that his brother had died, so his brother had taken his own life, and he also had said he just found basically what was on offer, i.e. from the state, what was on offer was just pitifully inadequate. To honour a human life, you know. So I presume most of you have been to a funeral. I don't know, all the ones that I've been to, you get basically like 20 minutes in the crematorium. You know, and it's a bit, if, unfortunately, it can feel a bit like being on a conveyor belt. Not that that doesn't work sometimes. I've been at funerals where somehow it still works, but that's often what's on offer. And Jimmy Courtney was saying, look, this just wasn't enough. I wanted to do something more to honour not just his brother, but actually, you know, every human life. So he had the idea to build this pyramid, which I thought was amazing. Yeah, an incredible thing to get involved with, really. So that's what he'd said. And I was watching this TV program on Sunday, which my friend Abhay and Andy had tipped me off about. And I really, 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 really recommend this TV program. So it's called Rites of Passage, and it's on 4OD. I don't know, you've seen it, yeah. Has anybody else seen it? Yeah. Amazing television. Best TV I've seen in years. I don't watch much TV, but you know, it's better than The Apprentice, it's better than First Dates, which are the other two things that I watch. But really, really, really good. And it's Grace and Perry basically looking at different rites of passage, and the first one is about death. And he goes to a place in Indonesia, and he sees the death rituals of this people called the Toraja people, and they keep a dead body in the house for a year. They mourn the body for a year before they have a funeral, and all through that time people can come and mourn. And it was very, very moving, seeing these families mourning the dead for a year, particularly this old woman whose husband had died. Grace and Perry was asking her about her husband, and he said, how long were you married? And she said, 70 years. So they were married for 70 years, you know. So in a way, like a year, it's nothing compared to 70 years, is it? But it's, you know, really, really, really honouring the significance of him. And there's another moment where a woman comes in and she just breaks down next to her mother, saying, you know, mother, like, I miss you so much. Why have you gone? And yeah, just really, really incredible. And then they have this funeral in which the whole family takes part. And contrasting that with a family in Middlesbrough, which you can't get a more ordinary place than Middlesbrough. I'm from the northeast, and I know Middlesbrough a little bit. And there was this family there living on an estate, and they lost their son. So their son was 17, and he'd been killed by a driver who'd been drinking. And it was so painful and poignant to see this young man's mother talking about him, you know, and just saying how much they missed him. And one of the things that they did, it was interesting. So, well, two things actually. One thing that they did was they essentially built a shrine in their house. So they wouldn't use this language, but they built a shrine in their house, which was just all photos of this young man. Yeah, they'd done it in his colours, which were red and blue. I don't know if that, I think that might be the colours of the local football team, but so yeah, it was in the colours of red and blue. And Grace and Perry, through the programme, he made this beautiful picture of their son, and it was in this really wonderful frame. And in the end, he gave it to them for their shrine, which is really, really moving and very lovely. And one of the things that they did was, on his 18th birthday, they organised kind of a walk. They actually called it a pilgrimage, and it was a walk around all the places that he'd known. And they just did this themselves. They made this ritual up. So all of these things, I think, point to something that I have felt for a long time, and which Bante touches on in his lecture, which is that human life is this incredible mystery, isn't it? We don't know where we come from. We don't know what happens really when we die. I mean, I don't know if any of you were here few months ago, maybe 3-4 months ago, we did a seminar here called Death, Karma and Wisdom. And it was myself and Kusalasara and Maitreya Bandhu were doing that seminar. And I talked a lot about my father there because he died when I was 24. So almost half my adult life, my father hasn't been around in bodily form. But he's so present to me. You know, I can't quite describe what that means, but in some ways he's more present to me now than he was when he was alive. And it was interesting going back to Liverpool because he and I had spent a lot of time together there. I lived there when I was in my early 20s and he used to come down and visit me. And probably the best times I had with him was when he was visiting me there. And it was strange being in places where I knew that I'd been with him. He's very present to me. He's very alive to me. And Bhante also still feels very, very present to me. And I think will continue to because of the effect that he's had on me. And interestingly, in this program, Grayson Perry has this sort of kind of moment of insight, which is really, really lovely, where he's in Indonesia and he says, actually, I want to ask the question, when does somebody die? When do they die? You know, is it when we don't see them? Is it when we lose touch with them? Is it when their physical body goes? You know, I don't know the answer to that question, he's saying. Is it when we stop talking about somebody? Is it when we stop loving somebody? And I think that was one of the things that I was saying on the Karuna team retreat when I was leading this session on Bhante, is when somebody dies, one of the things that we can do is keep them alive actually just by talking about them. And that's something we do in my family as well, is we really talk about my father a lot. You know, he died 20 years ago. But my mother and sister and I, we talk about him a lot. He's very present in our conversations. So there's this mystery. We don't really know what happens. And yet somehow we've arrived at a place where we don't really honour that. Or what's on offer in sort of mainstream society is, you know, you wait a week or something and then you have this funeral and, you know, you go to the pub and you have some quiche or something and then that's it. You know, that's what my dad's funeral was like. It was nice, actually. You know, it was not a bad funeral, and I spoke about him and I said some words. But then we went to this pub in Wall's End, and then we had some quiche and sandwiches, and it was like, you know, his life meant so much more than that. And I contrast that with, I mean, I've spoken about this quite a lot, and for those of you that, and I don't know if anyone's here from that was on the spring retreat last year. I spoke about this quite a bit on the last day of that retreat. My friend Vidyajyoti died about 10 years ago, and her funeral was probably the most moving ritual I've ever been at in my life. It was just wonderful. It was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I'd not long been involved in Sri Ratna at that point, and I just thought, these people that do this, I want to be part of that, you know. Actually, all through her death, she was cared for so beautifully through her death and her dying. And I was with her when she died. And that's the first time I've been in that situation. Her funeral just felt like an appropriate celebration of a really, really wonderful woman. So how have we arrived at this point then, when largely what's on offer is not appropriate? And Bhante talks about this in the psychology of ritual. So I'm talking about death rituals, but actually you could apply this to any kind of ritual, really. And what he talks about in the lecture is that we've sort of arrived at a place where we're just very suspicious of ritual in general. So he attributes that to a couple of things. So he talks about the conditions for that being largely to do with scientific rationalism and psychoanalysis. And I'm not going to go into his argument around that too much, partly because I'm not sure I completely understand it, but partly because it's not the thrust of what I'm trying to say. But basically what he's saying is that in the modern Western mindset, people think that ritual has no place, that it's something we've kind of moved on from essentially, that it's something that is attached to a kind of an old style of religion, and that we don't need it, and it doesn't have a place in a Western mind. So, you know, I think it's interesting seeing how Bante gave this lecture in 1968. So at this point, he was just setting up the movement. And I think this lecture is interesting because he's giving it at a time when Tree Ratner is just in, or the FWBO as it was then, is just in the process of coming into being. And it's almost like he's setting out what kind of movement we're going to be. And I think his experience at the time was, well, it was very much that people were just practicing Buddhism as a kind of a hobby or as a sort of an intellectual pursuit. Because he's not saying this in the abstract. I mean, one of the examples that he gives in the lecture is he says that the Buddhist Society's summer school in 1964, he'd suggested to the people that were running it, because there's no ritual on the program at all, and he suggested to people that were running it, maybe we could try doing some Buddhist ritual. And the answer that he got was a little bit like, no, I don't think we want to do that, you know. And he said that what he'd noticed was that usually about six or seven people were coming to most of the lectures. And he said, he said, well, look, let's just try doing something simple. Let's do a simple puja. So he did a simple puja, and he said the whole of the summer school turned up, about 140 people. Mm-hmm. And he said this incredible atmosphere was created. They just kept doing it night after night then. But he's saying that the sort of approach to Buddhism back then was very much, it was sort of intellectual, basically. And you can see this. I see it in broader society, and I see it here sometimes when I come across people who are quite new, or maybe aren't that familiar with our practices, or often people have a bit of a resistance to ritual. I have to admit that I'm very resistant to people's resistance to ritual, because for me, I just love it. I absolutely love it. When we were on the spring retreat last year, my friend Vandana Jyoti and I were co-leading, and she said, oh, let's do a session on for people who don't like ritual, where we talk about it. And I was just like, no, let's not do that. Can we just please not apologize? But actually, we did do that, and it was wonderful. It was the highlight of the retreat for me, actually, because Vandana Jyoti is somebody who historically, not now, but historically, had a bit of resistance when she first came along. I'm completely the opposite. I just love it. I love puja. I love chanting. I love any form of ritual, really. And we interviewed each other, basically, and we're sort of talking about our attitudes, and it was very, very lovely. But people sometimes are quite resistant. And I think in mainstream society, people are resistant to any sort of form of ritual or anything that they think might be a bit sort of religious. And I really noticed this when I was at Toxteth Day of the Dead. It was really funny because I was with this friend of mine who's a very good friend. But he basically says, I'm very suspicious of... He's not a Buddhist, by the way. But he says, I'm very suspicious of any organized, religion. Don't like it at all, you know. And we sort of had these conversations, very interesting, where we're engaging about these different issues. And there he is basically worshipping this pyramid of shopping trolleys. walking around Toxteth, sort of with everybody wearing costumes with like horns and chanting and stuff like that. And then kind of like, you know, all doing this sort of elaborate kind of shared ritual, you know, but he's very, very suspicious of, I just thought that was quite funny. But in the lecture, Bante talks about what ritual is, and he uses Eric Fromm's definition, which is that it's shared action expressive of common strivings rooted in shared values. And there's so much in there. I might not have time to talk about all of it, actually. But it's shared action. That's what he's saying. And this is why it's important in our community, is it's a shared action, expressive of common strivings, rooting in shared values. And I was looking back over all the things that I've been involved with and kind of realizing that this shared expression of values is something that we deeply need as human beings. But it is a kind of a shared action. And I was thinking, well, two things there. So action is one part of it and shared is the other. So with action, it's interesting. Bhante is saying it has to be something that you actually do. And he very importantly makes the point that he's saying, look, human beings are more than just our mind. You know, he's saying that actually in ritual, what you have is actions of body and speech, as well as actions, for actions of mind, we meditate, we study, all of those sorts of things. But we also need to do something with our body, and we also need to involve, you know, aspects like speech. And it was interesting just thinking back to this Toxteth Day of the Dead, the Karanar team retreat, you know, where we're doing the dedication ceremony, we're doing puja, we're doing chanting, and thinking about this Grace and Perry program where nobody had told this family to do this walking pilgrimage thing. It had just sort of emerged for them that this is something they wanted to do. And it was funny, it was the same with this little pilgrimage I did for Bhante. Mm. We don't do that. It's not a thing that we do. But somehow I wanted to do it. I wanted to engage my body. So I walked around Covent Garden and I bowed at these places that were significant for him. So it was Monmouth Street, where the first classes were held for Tri Ratna, and Watkins, where he bought his first Buddhist text from. So I bowed at these places, and then I cycled to Tooting, and went to the tube station, because when he was a little boy, that's where him and his sister used to meet his father, and then they used to walk home. And it was lovely just to be at that place, thinking of Bhante as a little boy, but doing something physical. And Bhante talks about this here and just says it's very, very important to engage all of ourselves, and that can be a physical activity. And it's a shared action. So puja is a shared activity. Chanting is a shared activity. And it's important that we think about that and that we bear that in mind. We might not always be aware of that when we do it, particularly if we bring a kind of a mechanical mindset to it. We can just sit there and, you know, the words just trot out. And our mindset is incredibly important. We need to be conscious of what we're doing, of the significance and the import of what we're doing. And we also need to be aware that it's a shared action. So I could give a whole talk on the significance of puja, but I'm just going to concentrate for now on the fact that it is a shared undertaking. So this put me in mind of when I was younger. I think I've told this story before, but when I was younger, when I was in my mid-20s, I lived in India for a year, and I lived in a spiritual community there called Ashaniketan, where you live and work with people with learning disabilities. And it was a very, very formative time in my life. So I lived there from 1999 to 2000. And so living with people with a learning disability who'd been on the street at some time in Calcutta. And it was a community of different faiths. There was Muslims, Christians, Hindus, and this one Buddhist. And every evening we do prayers and a puja. And like our puja here, the puja would finish with three shantis. So you'd say, at the end of a puja, we say Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. And the three represent body, speech, and mind. So shanti of body, shanti of speech, and shanti of mind. And shanti means peace. And what was really lovely in that community was that we would mark the fact that it was a shared undertaking, because at the end, we would actually, you'd make eye contact with every person and you would say shanti to them. So it would be like you would give them shanti. So like, I'm giving Manjusia shanti, I'm giving Yanavacha shanti, I'm giving Raj shanti. And it worked because, there was, say, 15 of us or something like that. So you could do that. So at the end, we would actually connect with the fact that it had been a shared practice, which was really lovely. And one night in the shrine room, two of the young kids that were living there, he was about 10 years old, a fist fight broke out in the shrine room. And it was basically, so I said to Rambabu, who was one of the little children that I lived with, he'd started this fight. And I said, look, what are you doing? You know, this is a shrine room. It's a holy place. You know, why? What happened? And it turned out that Manisha, who was one of the other children, hadn't given him shanti. So Rambabu said, well, he didn't give me shanti, so I punched him. So that was lovely. Bless them. So yeah, it's a shared action. So it's something that we do together. And it's not just a spectacle. It's something that we have to participate in. This really made me think, you know, this thing of it being a shared action. What happens in a ritual, and I've experienced this particularly in puja, is that an atmosphere is created. And the more you have a sense of being together, the more that atmosphere is created. And I say, for example, on the spring retreat last year, what happens is, as the days go on in the retreat, somehow the atmosphere gets deeper and deeper in the puja. And it's because people are giving themselves. So people are basically really fully participating, and more so as the days go on, and then something really happens. And especially if people are really sort of committed to being there. And then also I had a real experience of this when I first started going to Padmaloka, which is a men's retreat center. And when I first started going there, it was for ordination training retreats. So you go on these retreats in the lead up to being ordained. And it was the first time I'd been on retreat with people that were similarly as committed as I was at that time. So everybody that was there had asked for ordination, wanted to move towards giving their life to their Buddhist practice. And there was a tangible difference for me, I think, in the pujas there, that people were very committed to what they were doing. The atmosphere was very, very, very strong. And I found this on the Karuna team retreat last week as well. Being in a community, knowing people, and were there with shared aspirations, again, the atmosphere that was created in the puja was very, very strong. So we can ask ourselves then, why is this necessary? And this is what Bhante asks in the lecture, is why is it necessary? You know, if we're intelligent people, and we've arrived at a point where we think that ritual's not important or it's not necessary, we've looked at why that might be the case, but why is it necessary? And basically the answer that Bhante gives is that because we're hearts as well as head. You know, there's a wonderful word in Buddhism, which is citta, which it means something like heart-mind. And I really loved what Jnanavacha was saying in the first half of this evening, is that actually, if we're really going to engage with Buddhist practice, it's not just a mental pursuit. It's not just a conceptual approach that we need to take. And it's not just a rational approach. So we don't need to exclude that. That's important. But we have to have more as well as that. We have to have our emotions engaged. We have to have our heart open. And ritual can help us to do that. It speaks to our emotions, and it goes beyond the language of concepts. So when we engage in a ritual, it's a language of myth and mystery, and it's something much deeper than concepts. And Bhante talks about this as kind of reaching into the depths. So he says that when you do a ritual, you're reaching into the depths so that something can come up from the depths and be seen or be recognized. And he talks about it as kind of reconciling the difference between what we think with our heads and what we know in our depths. And it's strange to think about what that might mean. I mean, I sort of reflected a little bit on this after hearing the talk, but two experiences of mine came to mind. So one was when I was on my ordination retreat about 5 years ago, and it actually wasn't a particularly pleasant experience, but it was a very, very strong one and a very profound one and very, very positive, which was getting up to about halfway through the retreat, and we were coming close to the point where we were going to be ordained. And we had 2 weeks of total silence. Total silence. 2 weeks is a long time when you're in total silence. And lots of meditation and lots of puja. And basically, I accessed parts of myself that I've never accessed before in those conditions. And what happened was interesting. Two things. So one was that my meditation practice deepened in a way that it never had before. I suddenly found that I was having very strong, very beautiful experiences in meditation, unlike anything I'd experienced before. And at the same time, I was experiencing absolute rage. So anger like I've never experienced before. I kind of have a view of myself as not being an angry person. You know, I'm really nice and everyone likes me and all of that sort of thing. But it's clearly not the case. In totality, not that that's not true, but and I don't know where it came from, but there was some anger that I'd never experienced anything like this before. And I think what was happening was I was getting to my absolute depths, and it was lovely that this was just before ordination. So in a sense, what I felt was that all of this was coming to the surface in order to be purified as I was about to enter this very, very significant ritual. So there was that, and then there's something else, and I can't remember what the other thing was. Will it come back to me?
Was it the time you went to Amaravati?
No, it wasn't that, actually. But thanks, Tom. I'd like to introduce you to my secretary, Tom. what was the other thing? Yes, that was it. The other thing was... when my father died, after a couple of days, I developed this intense pain in my heart. And I didn't know what it was. It didn't seem to have any medical basis. But I had this pain in my chest cavity. And it came on about 2 days after my father died. And I didn't know what it was. And then a really strange thing happened, which was that I gave a eulogy at my father's funeral. And as soon as I'd finished giving the eulogy and I walked out of the crematorium, I noticed that the pain had disappeared. It was a very, very strange experience. But the ritual of celebrating my father and going through his funeral and giving the eulogy somehow resolved this physical pain that I had in my chest, which was very, very strange. So... I think what I'm trying to say is that ritual is it's a deep human need, because what we're doing is expressing something very, very deep within us that needs to be expressed. And if it doesn't get expressed, well, I think it means that we're not very healthy as a culture and a society. And interestingly, with a lot of the examples that I've talked about, it seems that actually, if it's not provided for, people will just start doing it themselves. And I think, actually, I would encourage people to do it for themselves if they find that it's not catered to. But interestingly, in Sri Ratna, I think we do ritual extremely well. I think, you know, I've talked a lot about death and mourning, and I think we do that very, very well. And I think a lot of that is Bhante's influence. And really, in giving this talk, what I want to do is sort of honour him, really. And one of the qualities that I want to honour in him is he never just took things as he found them. So, you know, he found the Buddhist movement in the West at that time in the way it was. And one aspect of that was that they just weren't interested in ritual. And he just wasn't having that, basically. And he never, ever just took things as he found them. He never went along with anything. There was a lovely poem that was read on the Karana team retreat last week. I can't remember much of it, but one of the lines, it was written by Padmavajra, who some of you will know from this class. And there's this refrain, which is thinking things through. He says, Bhante was thinking things through, always thinking things through. And it's like he had this vision, and Well, I found it very moving. After I'd listened to this talk, I watched a little strange TV program from the late 70s, early 80s, called The Enlightened Englishman. It's about Bantu. And at the end, people ask Bantu what they want his legacy to be or what they want him to be remembered for. And he says, well, what I hope I've given, what I want to be remembered for, or what I hope I've given, is a vision for what a human being can be, or even a vision for what humanity can be. And I found that very, very moving. And thinking about this in relation to this and so many other emphases and teachings that he's given, well, what it's enabled me to do, and so many people that I know, is live a really, really wonderful, truly human life that I think reaches into the highest echelons of what a human being can be. And he's given us the potential even to go beyond that. And when I say teachings, it's not like, you know, just these sort of abstract teachings. And this is the thing, is what we have is a whole culture. I don't know if culture is the right word, but a whole culture and a whole movement where you can participate as much or as little as you want. But for someone like myself, who over the years has participated more and more and more, what I found is actually the more I commit to his vision and the more I participate in that and the more of my life I give to that, so I now spend a lot of time here, which brings me a lot of joy. I work for Karuna, which is a Sri Ratna Buddhist charity. You know, my life's very simple in a certain sense, much simpler than it ever used to be. And I've just given more and more of myself to Bantu's vision. And the result of that is that actually I just feel more and more joyful and more fulfilled. So I'm extremely grateful for that. So yeah, I hope that in some way what I've said sort of goes some way towards honouring Bantu and his vision. I did actually mean to stop and ask if anybody had any questions, but we've run out of time, unfortunately. So I'm really sorry about that. But what I'd like to do is, I think it's appropriate and fitting that we end the evening with something rather than just getting up and leaving. It would be nice to end with something that sort of, well, chimes with what I've been talking about, really. So we're going to finish with some chanting, and we're going to chant the Tara mantra. And well, I'm not going to say much about who Tara is, but I'll tell you a little story before we do that. So Tara is a female Buddha figure, and it's said. So let's try and sort of create some of this. Some of this mystery that I've been talking about. It's said that if you call Tara, she appears. Said that if you call Tara, she appears. And I don't think I believed this until something happened to me a couple of years ago, which was very strange. I was out with my partner, who's also a Buddhist, and we were having dinner in a place called Jai Krishna in Finsbury Park, which is a lovely vegetarian Indian. And I'm embarrassed to admit this, but we were having this conversation, and I said to her, so she was talking about something about, somebody was talking about Tara, somebody was talking about green Tara, and then somebody else was talking about Tara. And I said, I don't know who this Tara is. Who is this Tara? I wish she'd just show herself to me. They say that if she appears, she shows herself to you. And when I say I don't know who Tara is, I didn't mean in the technical sense. I know who she is in that sense. But what I meant is I don't feel a particular connection with her. That's what I meant at the time. And then this really weird thing happened, which was, so we'd had that conversation, and then myself and my partner, Hanka, and you can check this out with her, I'm not making it up. We came out of the restaurant, and there was this woman stood over the road, and we both were totally captivated by this woman. It was as if her energy was pulling us towards her, and Hanka was really freaked out. And I said, look, and she said, I know. And she said, don't. I said, come on, let's go over. And she said, no, don't go. And I said, no, come on. So we went over the road, and this woman who kind of looked really odd, she looked like something from the Middle Ages or something, but she had this really weird kind of aura about her. And she just, she did two things. So she sort of did this gesture, which was, first of all, she did this. And then first of all, she just did this, which was saying, like, just go this way. And it was weird. The next day when I went back there, basically, there was this shop there, and it was completely decked in green all over. The whole shop was green. So she's basically going, like, green. And then we went to walk past her, and she just went like this, and we walked past. And Hanka was totally freaked out. Uh-huh. And I was a bit freaked out, but not as much as her. So who I don't know. I mean, basically, we talk about this as our sort of Tara moment, but it was really, really strange. I want to say, and wonderful, because we're about to chant her mantra, but it was a very strange thing. So call her and she appears. So what we'll do is, we'll just settle ourselves down for a couple of minutes. And then Diabhadra is going to lead us in the mantra. And we'll chant that for a few minutes, and then we'll just let that die away. And then we can leave quietly.